How long you say you've been working for Minnie?
4 months.
See, if you'd have been here 2.5 years ago, you'd know about that sign used to hang up over the bar. Minnie mentioned that to you?
No.
You want to know what that sign says, Senor Bob? No dogs or Mexicans allowed.
We're officially recording. Welcome to Mike Talk 2025.
Mm-hmm.
What are we here for, other than talk about mics?
We were going to talk about how bad The Hateful Eight was.
Oh, was that what? Okay.
Hmm.
The Hateful Eight? You mean the masterpiece film by Quentin Tarantino in 1998? I don't know. What year did it come out?
Did I watch the wrong one? Because I definitely didn't watch a masterpiece.
It was 2016, I think.
Was it really?
Yeah.
That does almost not feel 10 years like that ago. Long ago. It feels like longer.
That's almost 10 years ago, which is kind of crazy. And yes, you have the agenda wrong, Doug. We're here to talk about how good Hateful Eight is.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Do you want to just know about
it? You might want to check your memos and get on the same track. No, I'm
kidding.
Well,
then let me start off by saying my favorite part of how good The Hateful Eight was that it was filmed in a really old, obscure format that required special cameras and special film to provide a very wide panoramic shot, of which we then spent 90% of the film on an interior set.
Was it filmed on special film? Like, what do you mean? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was like Panavision super widescreen.
It's on 70mm.
It
was 70mm?
Yeah.
Okay, and I'll admit that's a little pretentious.
Quentin is a film nerd, so I can't hate on him for being nerdy about what he's into, but I'm not impressed by it either. Like, cool, you used a super widescreen format to film an indoor set. Like, that's
because the whole world had moved to digital by that point, and didn't they have a hard time sourcing the film?
You say by that point, the whole world had moved to digital like 20 years before that point.
Not 20 years. I mean, like
15.
Tell that to like Christopher Nolan.
Like the mid 2000s, that was when it like really started hitting. I do remember something about like he wanted to be old school and do on film instead of digital. And like, there's not a lot of companies that make physical film anymore, and especially not like special bougie fancy film like that. So they had to like, I shouldn't make this up, but I feel like they had to like spin up a factory, or they had to like dig deep into some archives to find.
I don't know.
Oh no.
I mean, tell that to Ryan Coogler, who just released Sinners. They did that on film. I mean,
oh, Sinners was film?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
I think it's just hanging on. It's hanging in there like the film format, like, you know.
Amazing.
What?
It provides so much more to the viewing experience for me.
I don't know. I think maybe you can feel it. Like, digital has a feeling. Definitely high frame rate has a feeling. Like,
did
24
you feel it? Did you feel it when you were watching The Hateful Eight? Oh my God.
I might have. I felt so like a very better. Cinematic. It was definitely a cinematic movie. Like, the soundtrack really put it over the top as far as cinematic feeling for me, but like the film format I'm not looking at the weeds as far as the film format goes. No.
Okay.
I'm not gonna nitpick it.
I wish I had known that, because then I would have watched for it. I was just telling Jason that I watched, what was that, Freaky something, whatever I was telling you. But anyway, the point is, it's kind of like this throwback sci-fi-ish film, and it's like take place in like the 80s or the 90s, and it has a very like VHS like look to it, you know, like it has some lines and some color separation, and it's really grainy.
Freaky Tales.
So from that aspect, it was kind of cool, just because it was just a throwback, right? It anchored it, like it set the movie in that time period, you know.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So I feel like if I had known that it was film, I maybe would have paid a little more close attention to it. No, I didn't notice at all.
I may be wrong, but I think it was pretty standard in Old West times to do all their motion picture on 70 millimeter film in the 1870s. That was the standard.
Well, it's based on Westerns, like the classic Westerns, not, you know, like, and so to have a retro film look, I mean, the format, the wide format, no, is a separate issue. But
and there are, I will concede this, there are some exterior shots, like when they're making their way to the cabin, where you get like the full scope of the mountains and the trees and the the trail that they're on, and it's pretty cool. It's really cool. And then a really weird decision to just be like, cool, now that we got that out of the way, let's do the entire rest of the film inside.
Well, it's almost like two completely different movies, right? Like you have like the lead up to get to the cabin. You have like all these separate plot lines of these characters getting to the cabin. And then like you could really have just started the movie when they're in the cabin and it would have made at least 90% of sense.
It's not a lot of the film before the cabin, right? It's just like...
It's a solid like 45 minutes.
Is it really that much?
I mean, you got like the introduction and then you have banter inside the stagecoach and then there's another introduction, more banter inside the stagecoach. Yeah, I want to say it's probably a good 30, maybe 45 minutes before they're actually...
It's a serious chunk of time, because I remember thinking the first time I saw it that it was 50-50, so I was paying attention the second time, and it's not nearly that much, because it's almost a three-hour movie.
No.
Like, it's really long. I didn't remember it being that long.
You're 100% right, though, because I do remember, once they got to the cabin, feeling like, oh my God, are we through the initial setup yet? Like, can we get to the actual movie? And then they kept introducing more new characters, of which I was then trying to keep count, like, which one of these are the eight?
Yeah. Do you know, I watched the extended edition, and I mean, so it was like 2 hours and 55 minutes. Did you guys watch the extended edition? Do you know?
I'm
actually
sure.
Curious how long the theatrical version was, like how much they restored, because I don't remember.
I watched it in theater, and they had the intermission, and I believe I watched the same version, you know, from what I remember, and it was like 3 hours. I didn't know that it was a 3 hour and 55 minute one.
No, I think it's 2:55, isn't it?
The it's like 2:50 is the standard length. You said it was.
That's the theatrical length?
Yeah, 2 hours and 48 minutes, I think.
Yeah, and it felt. Every bit of that.
Every minute of that.
Just like, minutes. Just juicy, intense, dripping with drama.
The whole thing was just a giant slog to get through. Like, every scene just left me, like, wanting something to happen. It was like, ooh, tension and build up, and then nothing really happens.
What?
Something happens, and then it's like, I don't even really give a shit about that guy.
Oh my gosh, but nothing happens. There's so many twists and turns in the movie. There's so much.
I mean, twists and turns are more interesting when I care.
Well, that's. I mean, if you're not in on it in like early on in the movie,
what was the best twist?
I don't know. Like, I mean, obviously. The main twist was that the group that was in the cabin had, you know, were actually planning the whole thing
was a setup.
It was
like
a whole setup
to
get the woman, Jennifer Daisy Domergue. Yeah, they were just trying to rescue her, basically.
There, okay. Besides the like the twists and the turns, there were some really good performances.
Channing Tatum, pretty good twist.
Like Samuel L. Jackson.
My favorite, my favorite is Samuel L. Jackson.
Like he had so many great lines and like he so many like great deliveries. When they're in the stagecoach and he's talking about the letter he got from Lincoln.
Yeah.
And then you find out that it's bullshit, and then
it's
you find out
bullshit.
That maybe it is true. Like it's just whatever. Just like that storytelling, like that sort of like threw me back like to the good old days of Quentin Tarantino. Like his strength is like the dialogue and setting up these crazy scenarios that are really interesting, you know, and then
yeah, just the twist. I thought that was probably one of the best. I mean, it's not a major twist, but the twist of Samuel L. Jackson, you're kind of figuring out his true identity and how he like slaughtered, you know, all the, his escape from that prison and like slaughtered the Confederates, you know, a lot of
where he's telling that story Walton about Goggins that family, that kids so. That got that old guy his son and mm-hmm. he made him suck his dick.
Yes.
Like
okay.
Like yes. I made him walk through the snow and no clothes and this no is, shoes and then I got to the end and like all he had left was to yeah. That speech was amazing. Like what the like talk about kicking a dude when he's down. Like this old guy can barely move and he's just like make them listen to this horrendous story. Like mm-hmm. Samuel Jackson, I thought like really knocked it out of the park.
This is my favorite Samuel L. Jackson movie, period.
Really?
Oh yeah. This is his best, I think his best movie for me. Yeah. I mean, what's better? What do you like?
Revenge of the Sith, man.
I mean, I'd have to go look at his IMDb. I mean, he's got an insane career. To say this is the best?
I would say I'm not it's the really biggest good. Don't Samuel get me Jackson wrong, but fan. I mean, I like a lot of his stuff. There's one like, it's Negotiator. I really like that one. He's like a lead in that one. Mm-hmm. You guys seen Negotiator?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then his other like Quentin Tarantino movies are really...
I was going to say, I feel like he was stronger in Pulp Fiction. He had more lines in this, but like... His character in Pulp Fiction.
I think this one blew me away. His performance. Just watching it again and like just the turn face of him. Like you finding out that he's not really the good guy that he says so, he was, and just like you know, I don't know. He really embodied that really well. I don't know.
I will definitely concede there are some powerful performances. Like Samuel L. Jackson does do a hell of a job. Kurt Russell.
Did a great job.
Walton Goggins, great.
Yes.
Has Walton Goggins been in anything that's not great? I feel like everything he does is just kind of great.
I'm sure if I looked on IMDb, I could probably find some stuff that's a little bit like less than
have
awesome.
Have you watched Sons of Anarchy?
I have not.
Have you?
Oh yeah.
His role. I would say
I got to remember what was his role in Sons of Anarchy.
He was a trans woman in that.
That I do remember him being a trans woman. That was in Sons of Anarchy. Yeah, I was thinking that was something else. That's what I'm saying. Like everything he does is really solid.
Yeah.
But despite all the powerful performances in there, there's a fundamental flaw with the whole concept. From the very beginning, all of the characters that we're introduced to were presented with a sort of shady like backstory on them, and we don't know, are they lying? Are they telling the truth? Every character is presented with a bit of an air of mystery around them, right?
What, you didn't trust Bob? The Mexican? Bob the Mexican?
No.
I thought that was a good build-up. That was great. Because, like, yeah. I mean, I was convinced at the beginning. I've seen this movie before. Yeah. I didn't remember it. But like that scene where he's in the barn and you're like, okay, this guy's just a stable hand. And then he starts grilling him. I'm like, dude, the guy just takes care of the horses. Like, leave this guy alone. And he breaks him down. And then you realize that it's bullshit. Like, I mean, that was a throwaway character essentially. But like the dialogue and like the back and forth between them, I thought was really solid.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
but
it's great.
From an audience perspective, as we're being introduced to these characters, it's a little bit... what's the word that I'm looking for? You don't know who you can latch on to as a protagonist. You kind of, and I get where I'm going with this, the movie name, you kind of don't like anybody. Like, they're all bastards
they're
in
all
their
pretty
own
pretty despicable,
way.
Right? I mean, there
nobody
isn't...
is good. Everybody is kind of deplorable. Some of them are worse than others, I guess you could argue, but they're all... characters that I don't care for.
I mean, I feel
do you
like,
have to like the characters to think they're good characters though?
I mean, to feel emotionally invested in whether they succeed or fail with whatever they're trying to do, yeah, it kind of helps to like a character. If I don't like them, then I kind of don't want to see them
succeed.
I mean,
I would say I latched on to Kurt Russell's character more than any far as like
right up until he's beating a woman, a restrained defenseless woman in the stagecoach.
Well,
he's kind
not,
of an asshole.
She's not an innocent
She's not either. She's kind of an asshole.
Yeah.
But that's just that they're all kind of assholes.
Well, but isn't that hard to do, though? I mean, clearly that was a choice he made to make all of the characters despicable.
Yeah.
It's hard to not have a good guy. It's hard to not have a character that you, to get and the audience to root for them.
You're 100% right. And it's hard as an audience to give a shit about any of the characters when I don't like any of them.
See, I didn't feel like I had to like them too. Like I said, like I enjoyed Samuel L. Jackson's performance, even though he's terrible, right? I mean, he's arguably probably the least terrible of all of them, but...
I know I'm jumping to the end here, but the final scene when it's, you know, Walton Goggins and Samuel L. Jackson making their stand, and it's kind of clear, like, yeah, they're shot, they're going to die, everyone's going to end up dead. And I'm just kind of like, eh, I don't... really care. I'm not invested. They take her out and they shoot her. What'd they do? String her up or whatever?
I don't even remember now. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't specifically remember because I didn't specifically care.
I don't think what I'm arguing is I don't think it matters. Like, I don't think you have to want the characters to succeed for it to be good.
Yeah. But I still don't know. I rooted even Walton Goggins, who's like I kind of liked a lot of the characters actually. I think they were pretty cool. In the time period, like Samuel L. Jackson plays a ruthless killer, but like that's who he kind of has to be in that period, in that moment of his life. Like he escaped from, you know, that story of him escaping from the Confederate prison and like burning the whole place down and like, you know, getting some joy from that. That's a lot great, but like, I don't know.
But it's understandable, right? Like,
it doesn't like make me not want to empathize with that character and what they're going through in any given moment in the movie. You know, even Walton Goggins, who's like a you know, Southern apologist and, you know, I guess was known for being like a Southern gang. Anyway, he started to like appeal to me when he worked with Kurt Russell's character a little bit. And you just kind of like sense what they're going through really well. They really embodied those emotions. And I don't know, you just empathize with them moment to moment rather than like standing back, I judge this whole character and I'm putting a judgment on them. I'm just more trying to enjoy, you know, live in the moment of the movie.
I think that's a good point because like there is like the first time Kurt Russell punches Domergue in the stagecoach. And like you said, like she's restrained and she's a woman. And I remember thinking like, what the fuck, man? Like, that's really dark. Like, he's asserting like massive male dominance on this lady. But then later on, like you realize, like you said, like she's a really terrible person and they have this backstory. And then, yeah, so moment to moment, like, oh yeah, okay. Yeah, maybe she does deserve to get punched or maybe whatever. I don't have to like him as a whole, but, you know, understand all the shit that he had to go through just to get her arrested and in that stagecoach at all.
Okay.
I think there's something to be said like maybe liking is a strong word, but you know, connecting with characters on an individual scene basis.
It kind of goes to the whole topic of the N-word, the use of the N-word, really. Like, what do you guys feel about that in the movie?
I have no problem with, because just in historical context, I mean, that's what they would have said, right? I mean, it's in Huckleberry Finn, right? They drop that all the time. Is it appropriate in 2025? No, but back then, that's just what they were called, right? I mean, they...
Back in 2016?
Well, I mean, no. It wasn't said in 2016. But if
Quentin Tarantino said it a lot in 2016.
Well, is he racist? Like, does he have a public persona now of being... I don't get that impression from him.
No, I don't think he has a public persona of being racist. I do think he has a public persona of being a foot fetishist.
Well, that's true.
Which, actually, now that I'm thinking about that, I don't think we saw any feet in the whole movie.
There's no feet in the entire movie?
It's a bit of a milestone for his career, right?
Wow.
I guess it's lacking a key Quentin Tarantino.
Do you think, is Hateful Eight, is it a heist movie?
No.
What kind of movie? I mean, I know it's a Western, but like, what's the underwriting theme?
More like a whodunit, because you're trying to figure out kind of a mystery.
It's a mystery box, but like,
okay,
you don't know what the mystery is. Is kind of the crux of it.
And then the mystery turns out to be this elaborate scheme to unkidnap Domergue.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Also, what kind of name is Dahmer Goo? Like, every time they said that, I'm like, what the fuck? Name. It's just a weird name. It's not French. It's not English. It's just like some weird... I mean, it sounds like something like a fourth grader would call somebody on the playground.
It's a fine name. It's fun. It's funny. It's a funny sounding name, but I don't know. They're creative names, you know. Bob.
Yeah, we got Bob. We got Dahmer Goo.
Got Mannix.
Clearly.
Tim Roth as Oswald Mowbray.
Yeah, Tim Roth. I forgot about Tim Roth.
Yeah.
Bruce Dern as General Sandy Smithers. But yeah, Tim Roth was great as a British executioner.
I feel like Tim Roth is one of those guys that's kind of great in everything he does, too.
You know what? Yeah. I want to go back to my earlier statement about I was having a hard time finding a character that I liked. I actually did like Tim Roth, but only because he was the least outwardly bastard character in the whole thing. Until the end, when it turns out, no, he's totally a bastard. But
That's interesting. I guess to be so turned off by the characters, and that's why I bring up the N-word thing, because it's cringy to hear that, like, people say the N-word.
So you have a problem hearing it in 2025?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Really?
I do.
Well, even in the context of a movie, of the 1800s.
I can accept it in the context of that and not, like, get outraged over it. But on a visceral level, like it just doesn't.
You have to get over it because it's representing a time period, right?
Yeah.
And that once you do, it's like, yeah, okay. But the same goes for the characters in that situation, in that time period. Like, it's not like they had, you know, a federal government, you know, like a solid law enforcement system. It was like bounty hunters and, like, you know, gangs, and like it was after the Civil War, so, like, you know, that things were in, I don't know a lot about that history, but, like, it wasn't exactly a stable period, I would assume, in American history. So, like, you had to be a pretty ruthless individual to probably survive and thrive in that period.
I disagree on that. I think there were millions of people who moved out west who were law-abiding citizens who managed to get through life without murdering a room full of people.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, yeah, you know, I don't think anybody wanted to murder the entire room of people. Like, you had certain...
Pretty sure the gang that took over that place wanted to.
They...
That was kind
probably
of
probably if they could get
goal.
Away with just... You know, getting, yeah, okay, the gang is not exactly, like, good people. They're not all good people. I'm just saying, I look at the motivations of them. I don't see anybody with, like, evil motivations. I see people with motivations, you know.
Wait a second.
Not good motivations.
They're literally all trying to murder each other, and you're like, I don't see anybody with bad motivations.
I'm not placing judgment.
Nobody's doing anything wrong. It's just a little killing between
it's
friends.
It's just like, yeah, it's just a, like, well, just crap, like, load of people all trying to kill each other.
I guess I'm just not judging them because they're not real people. So my point is, I'm looking at them from within the context of the movie and what the movie's trying to say.
That's totally valid, but... If you can look at them and not judge them for being despicable people, why does the N-word, why is that a problem? Because that did not even register for me at all.
Not at all.
Just because it's 100% time period appropriate.
But even then, it's there are some people that say that a white person should never say that word, no matter what context, whatever. Like,
sure,
and
okay.
I kind of understand that, but I don't agree with it. And I'm not saying I was... like, offended by that at all. It's just, like, hit me a little bit, and then you get over it because, yes, they're displaying a context that they want to portray in the movie, and it's all about that context. It's not about your outside judgment of their characters. I don't know. But I guess I see what you're saying. If you don't like anybody in it at all, and you don't care enough about any of the characters, then I can see why you wouldn't find it intense in certain moments, because I was definitely, like, on the edge of my seat even watching it a second time.
Okay, I do want to touch on something that you just said, the intensity. Because, yeah, there were some pretty tense scenes where, you know, everybody's kind of staring angrily at each other and you're wondering, like, okay, what's going to be the catalyst that sets everything off? And then you reach the, I'm trying to remember what part of the movie, was it like the third part or the fourth part, with the poison, and and Quentin Tarantino does a voiceover narration explaining that, like, while so-and-so was doing whatever they were doing, they didn't notice that someone had poisoned the stew or whatever.
You just hate hearing him speak.
It was so... It took me completely out of it.
Yeah, that's true. Because
he hadn't
weird.
Done any voiceover through the whole film. And then here we are halfway into it, and he's like, suddenly I'm going to narrate what's going on. Okay, Quentin, why don't you just let us watch what's going on? Because that's what you've been doing up to this point. But no, it's such a subtle, sneaky twist that he has to make sure to point it out to us via voiceover narration, which totally took me out of the tension that was building up and totally made me right back to the, oh, right, I'm watching a Quentin Tarantino movie.
It's going to turn out
hate him so much.
It's going to turn out that was notes from the studio, and they required him to explain it or something.
I don't think he got any notes for this movie. I think Doug's right that was just an utterly indulgent.
You think Quentin Tarantino's so big he's above getting notes from a studio?
I think at that period of time, yeah. I think he is still, yeah. I think he is,
really?
Probably. I think this movie wouldn't be 3 hours with an intermission if there was any studio notes.
I'm going to look it up, because I really don't feel like it was that long in the theater, because I swear I watched the extended cut, so maybe... Maybe the Quentin Tarantino dialogue explaining it wasn't in the theatrical, and he decided for the home video release, he's like, I'm going to put my touch on it. I don't know.
No, yeah, I remember seeing that in the
theater. We were able to see what was going on with the stew because of the 70mm widescreen format.
Yeah, right.
Like, we could see both sides of the room at the same time.
That must have been super expensive, too, because 70mm film is expensive to begin with.
I know, right?
Especially in 2016 when it's, huh.
And you're right. You're right that it's mostly used for indoor shots, which doesn't highlight it
like
that much.
But it
also gives you kind of a claustrophobic feeling because you're like seeing all the walls almost all the time, and so you're like you're not. I think it is the effect he was going for was.
It's actually funny that you use the word claustrophobic, because I actually remember thinking while watching it more than once, damn, that's a really big cabin.
Yeah.
Look how spread apart everyone is.
Can we talk for a second about the freaking door? Like, what is the deal with the door? Like, the hinge gets broken off, and
they have to
nail it shut. It's like the biggest, like, snowstorm ever. I mean, there's, like, holes, like, mm-hmm. An inch wide in that door. Like, it would have been freezing cold anywhere near that door. I was like, why are you nailing the stupid door shut? Like, put something over it or whatever, because, they're in the middle of this blizzard. The door, like, almost became a character unto it, because it got opened, what, 3 or 4 times?
Yeah.
And they always had to yell at the person.
You have to nail it.
You got to nail it shut.
But I think...
I loved that. I'll have more... go ahead. Sorry.
I think the door was a sort of reminder to us as the audience that, like, hey, something's off. Like, this mm-hmm. place isn't fully right. Something is wrong. And every time we go back to the door, it's like a reminder, don't trust it. Like,
there's chaos just outside the door,
brewing.
And it's screaming to get in.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Was it ever explained why the hinge was broken?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
It got shot when the gang came in.
That's why. Okay.
Yeah, they did flashback.
And the same thing, with the jelly beans that were on the top shelf, and that... One of them saw jelly beans in the floorboards, and he's like, oh, that's kind of weird. And then he looked up, and one of the bottles was missing.
Something like that.
You said, something's off here.
Yeah, there were little clues dropped throughout the whole film about, like when he's questioning about, I forget what exactly it was, but something that, like, the lady of that place would cook or coffee or something along those lines. And you just got the hint, little hints here and there about different things. Like, wait, something's not right. Something's not adding up.
There's a slow burn of, like, unease as it's slowly revealed, yeah.
Right. Unease, in my case, it was the emotion I would associate more was just kind of an impatience, like... Just get on with it. Like, ooh.
That's so interesting. But you tapped into the, like, the intense parts. I guess it was interrupted by Quentin Tarantino's voice.
Yeah, it was.
You're still, Yeah, I don't know.
Why are you surprised? Like, I'm surprised he watched the movie at all. Like, yeah, we didn't even, we're like, hey, we should maybe do that sometime in the future. And then Doug comes in on a Monday. He's like, I watched Hateful Eight this weekend. And I was like, yeah. Record scratched. Like, what? You did what?
I was ready to throw down right then.
I was surprised.
Well, let me explain to you guys why you were wrong about the Hateful Eight.
I feel like Hateful Eight is as much as it's indulgent, it's also like fairly contained, and like it's like a play, so there's not crazy set pieces, there's not crazy ideas involved. It's just like there's some gangs, there's some cowboys, there's some bounty hunters in a cabin, there's shootouts. Like it's got kind of the most basic elements of the Quentin Tarantino movies that are out there. So it's like, what about it is so bad? Like, because it's not
okay. Simply put,
wow, you really just teed Doug up.
Runtime was way too damn long.
Okay.
The scenes were set up and filmed in such a pretentious Quentin Tarantino manner. The characters, I didn't like a single one of them to the point where I gave a crap about their motivations. But you thought the
performances were good, right?
I can separate the performance of an actor versus the whole of the rest of the project. The whole of the rest of the project was gratingly annoying to me. I won't say that there was anything outright specifically terrible about it, but everything was like Quentin Tarantino nails on a chalkboard.
What do you think about the fact that he did, what was it, 5 chapters, 6 chapters? He broke it up into pieces instead of just one contiguous thing, like the different scenes.
Yep. That was a stylistic choice made by Quentin Tarantino to remind you were watching a Quentin Tarantino movie.
But what? Okay, that's far. I mean, he doesn't do that in any of his other movies. So how is that a hallmark of Quentin Tarantino doing scenes?
Playing with the linear format and, because there's flashbacks and
I feel like that's more indicative.
Having chapters, like Pulp Fiction is famously set in chunks,
But it's not specifically divided up.
Oh, sorry.
I'm saying I feel like that format where you have whatever different what are they called, chapters or scenes? I don't even remember.
I think so.
Eternities.
I feel like that was almost a more stylistic choice because it was a Western and that's how they used to tell Western style stories.
But, oh yeah, all famous Westerns that I know of are broken down into chapters. I guess
nothing
is
broken down into chapters anymore. Well, so that's why I'm trying to figure out where that came from.
Hateful Eight was broken down into chapters.
Oh, jeez. Now we're just going in a circle.
Yeah. Quentin Tarantino goes in circles.
You know what? It's 2025 and my attention span is about this long. So the fact that it was broken up into chapters made it really easy to watch. Like, okay, cool. I got through 25 minutes of a chapter. I can put this on hold until tomorrow. So I liked that aspect of it because I didn't feel like I had to sit and watch 3 straight hours of a movie.
I mean, maybe that's the right way to go. Instead of 70mm format, 3-hour runtime, he should have broken it up and did it on Disney Plus as a miniseries.
Yeah, just like a bunch of YouTube shorts.
Here's a 6-episode season 1 of The Hateful Eight.
Do you think this is Quentin Tarantino's most indulgent movie?
I don't know, Kill Bill movies are kind of crazy.
Oh, that's extremely style. I was going to say Django Unchained because that's really. But no, you're right.
As far as indulgent, meaning like he's just trying to put so many crazy ideas in and doesn't really consider the audience.
Yeah.
I mean. This is pretty indulgent.
Yeah, when I think indulgent, like he's filming it for himself and then rubbing one out in the editing room about how smart he is.
This is what I want to say, okay? You're the audience member that comes into this movie and says, it's too long. I need to cut it down. You're the studio that wants to cut this. The scene is too long. They're pausing on this intense moment for too long. We're going to cut a couple seconds out of this scene. No, this is gold. You should be appreciative of how awesome this is. And enjoy every moment of these actors having so much fun and like chewing the scenery and just extending it because I am enjoying every minute of that, the length of it. I don't understand.
So you wanted a 4-hour version of this?
Yes, I would have watched a 4-hour version. I get the criticism. You're right, Doug. You're right that this could have been cut down to a more normal length. A studio would have probably done that if there was more involvement. But you're just an asshole.
Wow.
You're right, Walter. But you're just an asshole. No.
I will concede this. I don't think I was the target demographic this movie was made for. I can see how it would appeal to some people. But I think you actually touched on something there, Baker. Quentin Tarantino makes films for Quentin Tarantino. That's his audience that he has in mind. He goes into a project with the mindset of, what would I like to watch?
Right.
And I think that's what he makes. The problem is, Quentin Tarantino and I have completely different tastes, and his films suck to me.
And that, I mean, that's fine. So I mean, you don't have to like his stuff. I mean, but don't they say that, like, you're making a video game, or you're writing a book, or you're making a movie? Like, make it for yourself. Make it something you're going to want to watch, because you're going to put more passion into it. If I write a book about, I don't know, fluffy bunnies or whatever that I don't have any, like, real connection with, but I know it's going to resonate with an audience, it's going to ring less true. Right. So, I mean, as indulgent as it may be, and, you know, he may be so excited about how smart he is when he's editing the movie, there's a lot of passion and intensity in there, I think he brings to that. And it may not be for everyone, and that's fine. But you can't argue that he put his heart and soul, like, he put everything into that.
Well, so did Francis Ford Coppola with Megalopolis, but
yeah.
Which was also great.
But that's amazing. That's why that point is besides the point. The auteur making something for their tastes, of course, a good artist is going to make something that moves them and hopes that audiences,
connect
with it.
That it resonates, yeah.
But
yeah.
What you can't deny is the skillful dialogue, the skillful film, you know, quality, directing, performances, music. I mean, this is Ennio Morricone coming out.
Who's Ennio Morricone? Like, retirement. You were all spun up about this guy.
He wrote the music for, like, all of the spaghetti western movies.
I mean, is that good? Were they known for having good music, or is it just more Quentin Tarantino?
He also did The Thing, which I just found out about. He did a song for The Thing that ended up not being in the movie, and they actually used that song in Hateful Eight.
Oh, that's amazing.
Wait, he wrote a song for The Thing and it didn't get used, so they put it in this?
Yeah.
Oh. So they're just recycling that song, assets that weird at this point?
Song, like, I don't know. You could maybe splice it into the podcast. It's fits perfectly in this movie. It's sort of like this weird
I think you told me he did the music after I had watched it, otherwise I would have paid more attention, because the music didn't stand out to me, but I wasn't listening for it either.
Oh god, and the Ennio Morricone soundtracks are so good. Like, they're just like, that's film soundtrack embodied.
Like, now, you know, you sound like Quentin Tarantino. You need a minute alone.
Anyway, I'm surprised that you don't appreciate, as a music, you know, person, music fan yourself, that you would appreciate the soundtrack, because it's amazing. And
what,
it's amazing.
Was it?
Yes.
Because it kind of.
It won the Academy Award.
Okay.
Oh, so it won the award for best soundtrack?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Well, now I want to listen to the soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not just a regular soundtrack. There's a lot going on with the soundtrack. There's, like, weird I don't know what, like, bass stuff going on. I can't, I'm not a music guy, but
like
there's weird, it's not
noises.
Like a normal score. Yeah, it's a great soundtrack. I will stand by that. You
okay.
cannot convince me otherwise.
I'll just say the soundtrack didn't really, it wasn't noticeable to me. Like, if I go back and re-listen to it, maybe I pick up on some of it, but I just don't recall anything.
If you're not actively listening for a soundtrack, is there a movie that stands out to you like OMG that has amazing music?
Hell yes.
Like what stands out to you as like this added to the movie without me having to pay attention to it?
John Williams, Duel of the Fates.
That, right.
Holy crap. The music in that scene. Oh, wow. That is perfection.
That was where I was going with that too. The only other one that really stands out to me is Jurassic Park, which is also John Williams. Like that.
That's also a good
one. When the dinosaurs walk in and the orchestra comes up, like that builds on the scene. Like I remember that, but I don't remember music from a lot of movies.
I know it's kind of a younger generational thing, but like the Harry Potter films, like when we're first flying into Hogwarts and stuff.
Okay.
Like,
Yeah.
That's also John Williams.
Is it really?
It is.
Did he do all 8 of the movies?
Yeah, John Williams, a genius.
I mean, you're not wrong there. I didn't realize that's what he did. What about...
About Time.
Yeah. I mean, it's either this or work, though, so... I mean, you just want to end it right there? Quentin Tarantino, genius. Ennio Morricone, whatever, also kind of great. Rubber stamp
God,
it.
You guys are so uncultured.
I just, you know, here's what I want to hear from Doug is on the list of Quentin Tarantino indulgent movies, where does Hateful Eight sit? Like, is it the bottom?
Okay, so I will 100% concede. I have not watched every Quentin Tarantino film in the same way that I have not sought to contract every sexually transmitted disease ever.
Wow.
Some things you just stay away from. Like, it's smart to just stay away from it. So,
but you, I know you've seen a handful. I'm just saying, on the hierarchy of what you've seen, is this...
Oh, it's bad. It's
this
really
is the,
bad.
The low end?
Like, yes. This is on the lower end. It might be the lowest. You mentioned Kill Bill earlier. That one's pretty bad. Like, there's... What is it? A whole 2-minute long sequence where she's like, wiggle your toe, and it's just a close-up of Uma Thurman's feet. And it's like, God damn, Quentin. You son of a bitch.
Talk about indulgent. Yeah,
I don't remember that, but that doesn't surprise me at all.
She's paralyzed. She makes her way out to the parking garage, and she's trying to, like, will herself to move again.
Right.
And it's just a close-up of her foot for, like, a minute, unbroken.
Of the sexual proclivities one powerful producer in Hollywood could have, that's not the worst.
That's
one.
That's on the low tier of freakiness.
I would just appreciate it if his freakiness and my freakiness aligned a little, because then I could enjoy some of that.
So what about you, Baker, as far as like when you saw it first and when you saw it now, did it move up? Or
I saw it so long ago. I mean, I guess it wasn't that long ago. It was only 2016. I don't know. I mean, I thought it was a fun ride. I really liked the characters. The dialogue was great. I didn't even remember the end, like when it happened, you know, like, I don't know. I thought it was fun. It was great. That was a fun movie.
Yeah, no, I remember being finished with it and saying, wow, that was fun. I did, actually.
I thought it was really fun.
I kind of did the opposite of that. I think I turned it off, threw the remote down, and was like, where did the last 3 hours go?
I mean, I honestly, because we talked about doing this, and I just assumed you would just kick the can down the road for a few years until we forgot about it, and then you'd never have to watch it. But then you came in, and you're like, oh, guys, I watched that Hateful Eight, so now we got to talk about it. So
yeah.
You had an out in my mind. Like, you could have just been like, oh, I'll watch it next weekend, guys.
Yeah.
You exceeded my expectations.
We appreciate it, Doug.
We appreciate you
taking one for the team, I guess.
That was quite the sacrifice to make, too, because, I mean, that's like a solid three-hour movie,
and you did
too.
It in one sitting?
Yeah, I did.
I didn't do that.
Dude, I think I watched it in 4 or 5 different pieces.
I think maybe 3.
If I'm being honest, I think I watched it on a day when I was on PTO or something, and I didn't have anything else. So
you took a day off work, and then you're just like,
well, I was
I gotta watch this movie I hate.
I think I was homesick, and I was like, oh god.
See, that's
like
probably
garbage.
He was probably already compromised.
Since I'm feeling like garbage, might as well throw some garbage on.
Poison the well there. Well,
All right, Doug, what are you going to make Jason watch so he can feel equally miserable?
Well, I think we'll get to that. But first, score out of 10.
I give it a solid 7.5. It was fun. I liked the characters and the story.
Okay.
It was an interesting way to tell a story.
All right.
I'm a big story guy. So.
What did you give Megalopolis?
I don't even remember now.
Was it like a 7 out of 10?
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so you put Hateful Eight on par with Megalopolis.
Again, I appreciate Megalopolis for trying. It didn't have to necessarily succeed. I just appreciate people that are really passionate about their stuff and put everything into it. Not everything has to be a home run.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, what? Rating is, I don't know.
No, do it. 1 out of 10. Scale of 10.
Well, as a movie, given a movie objectively, you know, out of all movies, not just Quentin Tarantino movies, I think it's like a 9. At least 9.5.
Wow.
I think it's almost a perfect movie. There's like almost nothing to complain about unless you're person. But like,
there's almost nothing to complain about except
it's
Doug's
just
complaint
so
for half an
enjoyable.
Hour.
The dialogue, the characters, the twists, the intensity, the scenery is amazing. The music. This movie had everything that I want in a movie. Like, I loved it. I loved the bottle episode type thing where they're all trapped in one environment and they hate each other. I mean, it's great. So yeah, I don't need to justify my score, but
I'm really dying to hear what Doug's gonna say.
Yeah, what's your score?
That's pretty difficult. I don't think I can justifiably give it like a 1.
Oh my god.
Because there was good costume design.
There was that one scene where the snow looked realistic.
Yeah, no.
I mean, so...
I'm sure the animal handler on set really did a great job, so...
That horse really nailed his role.
Oh, my God.
5 out of 10, would not watch again.
Fair enough. All right.
All right. We'll call it.
Bye.
Wait, how do we sign out of Andor? I forgot. I was just going to do it. Logic gate out. No, what was it?
That's it.
Was that it?
But this isn't Andor, is it?
No, I was just trying to throw back.
That's what's going to come up next. We're going to do Andor again,
right? Hell yeah.